at this point, I'd like to invite Rita Nakashima Brock and Virginia Farr, who will help us to reimagine, to come forward that we may bless you with Sophia's blessing.
Bless Sophia, dream the vision, share the wisdom dwelling deep within. Bless Sophia, dream the vision, share the wisdom dwelling deep within.
No.
Here.
So, oh. That was clear. Can you hear me now? I'm going to have to put this on my chin.
Now see.
Can you hear me now? I'll try to talk really loud.
Is that okay?
Is that all right? Let's switch. Okay. Now? Yay! Well, this is par for the course. When I arrived this morning, I thought I was going to have a podium for my notes and my little clock. And I found out, and I didn't wear anything with a pocket or a belt. So I was going to have to hold the microphone and my notes and my clock and stand up here and talk to you all at the same time. So someone graciously gave me a watch and donated her belt. So if there's someone during the dancing whose pants fall off, please be kind to her. She gave me her belt. I want to say how good it is to be back in this circle. It's wonderful to be here. And I know that in the year since some of us gathered together in this way last November, a lot of things have happened. I certainly did not expect a lot of that when I appeared last year. And some of that has been tragic. Marianne Lundy was fired from her job. I know a lot of clergy women have been harassed and questioned about their faith. And some of them have had their jobs in jeopardy. But there's also been some nice things that have happened. We got a lot of national attention. And we could never have afforded that much free publicity on our own. And the best piece of news, I think, is that Marianne Lundy has now been nominated to be the Deputy General Secretary of the World Council of Churches. She will be doing her radical work at the global level. She will be voted in November, so I urge you all to keep her in your prayers until that vote is taken and beyond, and to bless her work for us. I want to thank the planners for once again doing an amazing job, and also to affirm their chutzpah in selecting this topic for today. It isn't like they picked something safe and peripheral for us to talk about today. They decided to go straight for it and do Christology, to ask the question, who is Jesus Christ for us today? And as many of you probably know, there's a lot at stake in that question. It's a central question to Christian faith. And in some ways, it sums up every other question in Christian theology about how we relate to God, how God relates to us, how we relate to the world, and to each other. So this is not a light question we're going to tackle today, and we're certainly not going to answer all the questions. We'll probably have, I hope, more questions at the end of the day than questions we had at the beginning. And a lot of what I'm going to do for you today is simply to do that, to raise questions from a feminist perspective and a womanist perspective about Christology, about who is Jesus Christ for us today. Now, if you've been following the national controversy, one of the oft-quoted phrases of that controversy has been Dolores Williams' line, "I don't think we need an atonement at all." And I'm not sure how many of you were at the Reimagining Jesus workshop last year, but I thought I would at least summarize a little bit of what happened in that workshop to get us going, because atonement was, of course, a central subject in that workshop. Dolores Williams was raising the question of the redemptive value of surrogacy from her experience as an African-American woman and the history of African-American women in this country. And she argued that that has been a primary role of exploitation for African-American women under slavery and beyond, as domestic workers, as laborers to do the work of men, and as sexual surrogates in rape and other ways to bear children for slave owners. And so she argued that there's nothing at all redemptive about surrogacy, and that she did not want her salvation based on somebody else being a surrogate for her. And that's why, she said, "I don't think we need an atonement." And Kwok Pui Lan, a Chinese feminist Christian, raised the question of the atonement from a different angle. And she argued that in Chinese culture, there's not this doctrine of sin or this idea that there's something flawed about human beings. That in Chinese culture, human beings are believed to be perfectible, and that human beings are actually inclined to do good if they have good examples for that. And that in Chinese culture, there's some understanding that you might get sick or things might go wrong for you, but that isn't something that's essential to your nature. So the whole structure of atonement doesn't work very well in Chinese culture. And so she argued that in especially the Asian context, it's much more useful to talk about Jesus as good medicine. Which I think has interesting resonances to Native American traditions, but also that Jesus' suffering is an image of the suffering of the people of Asia, that his broken body is the broken body of women dying of AIDS in Thailand because of sex industry work, of people exploited by economic systems, that to her and to most Asian Christians was a much more meaningful way to talk about who Jesus is. And then Barbara Lundblau raised the question that I think in many ways is summarized by a story a pastor from Washington, D.C. told me this summer about his wife. His wife was a feminist, and his church decided to move to inclusive language, and the person in his church that most resisted that was his wife. And, you know, the church had all kinds of reasons about justice and images of from the Bible and all kinds of reasons for wanting more inclusive language in their worship, and the pastor's wife kept saying, No, God is male, God is male. And finally, when he pushed her on it and tried to figure out why she was resisting so fiercely inclusive language, she finally said, "I know this is silly, it's not rational, but I can't get my mind past the fact that no mother would have done to her son what God did to Jesus. And God has to be male." And Barbara Lundblau talked about when we think about what the atonement says, real carefully, there's a kind of collective gap as we ask ourselves, is this love? So I'm going to talk about three aspects of the atonement, I think, that are highly problematic in feminist and womanist thinking about the way that doctrine has played itself out. And the three aspects have to do with abuse, with suffering, and with love. We, the, the feminist community in the last 20 years has done an awful lot of work on the dynamics of abuse and battering and molestation and the psychological consequences of that and the way thinking works in abusive systems. There's been a lot of criticism from that perspective of this whole way that the doctrine of sin has worked in Christian thought. That it's very much like the way abused children accept the blame for their abuse by saying there's something wrong with me. If I'm suffering, if I am being punished, I know my parents must be good, so this must be something that I did to cause it. And from that angle, there have been serious questions raised about the doctrine of sin in Christian thought. Is this another way for us to take the blame for our own victimization when we suffer? Is this a way then to say that we all, in fact, deserve what happened to Jesus? We are that bad. And if we accept that, if we accept this idea that we are so bad, then does this make us helpless victims of abuse? That is somehow we are absolved of because somebody else takes our abuse for us. But nonetheless, there's this shadow of, well, we caused it in some sense. It didn't happen to us, but we caused it. How does that help us be accountable for our own behavior or make others accountable for their behavior against us? And abusive systems look for scapegoats or people to blame for a problem and then to punish. We know that about abusive systems. So I wonder if the question isn't so much who killed Jesus, but what killed Jesus? Is it our sin that killed Jesus? Or is it a huge, oppressive, exploitive system of power that he resisted that killed Jesus? Is it our personal sin, or is it, in fact, the way destructive systems build momentum and abuse power? These are some of the questions that come out of the question of abuse. And some feminist writers like Joanne Brown and Rebecca Parker have argued that doctrines of the atonement, in all of their various forms, we have many doctrines of the atonement, but they all, in some sense, make God either a bystander to abuse or an actual abuser. Because the question, of course, is, well, if God didn't do this to Jesus, but it's our sin that did that to Jesus, which is also part of this abusive system, then if God is all-powerful and God is the Father, then why was God standing there letting this abuse happen? Which leads us to the second question of suffering. Are we now, if Jesus is the one who dies in our stead, are we now then supposed to somehow rejoice that he suffered? Are we supposed to be glad that he suffered in our stead? And what does this say about our sense of empathy for suffering, if he is in some way a way that we avoid suffering? If we say that Jesus' death was necessary to save us, does it mean that we are saying that the forces of destruction, the people who hated him and killed him, were doing God's will? And that the people in his community who loved him and wanted to live him to live to be 100 years old were not? In other words, hate is right and love is wrong. And how does this doctrine, if one suffers, if one lives as a peasant in Nicaragua, or one lives as an abused child in a home in the United States, how does this doctrine empower you to resist evil instead of embracing your suffering as some kind of blessing from God? How are you in this understanding of salvation empowered to stand up to your batterer or your abuser? How does this give voice to people not who are sinful but who are sinned against? And how does this help us distinguish between forms of suffering? Because there are lots of kinds of suffering in the world, and some of that is inevitable. It's part of being a human being and being loving and living in the world. We lose people to death. We encounter our limits. There are all kinds of tragedies that happen, earthquakes. There are all forms, all kinds of forms that create suffering for us, of pain and sorrow, that are in some sense unavoidable. And part of being wise is coming to terms with that. Of making our peace in something. But there are lots of forms of suffering that are not necessary, that are unjust. And how does this doctrine help us distinguish between those two and make discerning judgments about when we can resist evil and when we should be outraged and resist? So that's another set of questions. And then the third set of questions focus around love. What is life-giving love? And feminists such as Audre Lorde, Carter Hayward, and others have argued that it is, in fact, the living presence of those who love us into being into full and mutual relationships that are life-giving. But those are the forms of love that give life. It is the way we somehow are able to be fully present to each other, open and mutually transformative, that this is the fullest expression of love. It is the fullest expression of a power that gives life in an ongoing way, this power of presence, of caring, of mutuality. And when we are not present in a relationship, when we are in some sense distrustful, held back, are in a kind of pain that does not allow us to be fully present, the relationship is diminished. It is in some sense broken because we are broken. So what does it mean when we say that Jesus' death, an act of self-sacrifice, exhibits the highest form of love? How is this life-giving? Can we speak instead of Jesus' self-investment in justice, his passionate, self-invested commitment to stopping hurt, to making things right, to making a better world, and that it is, in fact, our that kind of self, passionate self-investment, our presence in life, that in systems of oppression create huge risks, so that his death is not an act of self-sacrifice, but an act of all-out self-invested commitment and the willingness to take the risks that come with that. Risk-taking is part of life-giving relationship. It is the willingness to make oneself vulnerable to another because one hopes that that process will produce something more. And I think the pastor's wife haunts this issue of love. Is this love? What person with the power to stop torture and death would not act to stop it? And what does it say about God if God has that power and does nothing? To talk about atonement is in many ways to talk about central issues in our lives. It's to ask the question of how do we create a meaningful structure to deal with the suffering in our lives, to understand the suffering in our lives. How do we find images that tell us what love is in its most crucial forms. And how do we find means to resist evil, to resist abuse, to resist injustice? There are several things I think I want to close with that are elements of a consensus, or at least a lot of agreement in the feminist theological community around questions related to the atonement and around how do we find a theology that works for us. What are the criteria for adequacy and truth? It's very clear to me that
in feminist theology, salvation cannot be simply personal, as sin cannot be simply personal.
That the personal ways that we fail, and we all fail in some way, are so small compared to the massive systems of destruction that eat people up. And if we do not have a way to talk about that evil, of the kind of collective ways human beings get together, protect their power, and destroy others, then we really don't have an adequate understanding of either sin or salvation. Because the other element in salvation is not simply personal salvation, but justice.
And where does that live in your body? And as you become aware, I would invite you to ask yourself, what kind of response do those awarenesses call for? And to take a few minutes to respond in whatever way you need. It might mean to draw. It might mean to move.
I mean to journal, or to make sounds, or simply to rest in your own breath
and your own awareness. In your own breath and your own awarenesses as they bubble up. And as you become aware of that, to do what you need to do.